You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, independent voters are usually talked about as key to winning elections, but what do they really want? Our guest digs into the myth of the moderate voter. Now, the World Dairy Expo is happening in Madison all this week, and U.S. Agriculture Secretary is getting some attention for comments he made there yesterday. Sonny Perdue was asked about whether Wisconsin dairy farms could survive in the face of low commodity prices and the trade war with China. Perdue responded yes, but suggested they may need to get bigger if they're going to make it, as, quote, big gets bigger and small go out.
It's very difficult on an economy of scale with the capital needs and all the environmental regulations and everything else today to survive milking 40, 50, 60, or even 100 cows. And that's what we've seen. What we've seen is the number of dairy farmers go out, but the dairy cows haven't reduced that much. Those cows have not gone to slaughter. They've gone to someone else's herd.
Darren Von Ruden is a dairy farmer in Westby and president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your reaction to these comments from Secretary Perdue yesterday?
Well, it's really disheartening. You know, when you have so many farms that have went out of business already and so many more that are on the verge of going out of business, it really is not taken lightly by those farmers that are struggling. And just looking at some of the comments, too, as far as regulations are what's driving these 50 to 100, 150 cow dairy operations out of business, it couldn't really be farther from the truth. There isn't a regulation that costs me as a 50 cow dairy producer a penny to stay in business. The regulations that he's talking about that cost money are to look at or keep the larger farms playing by the rules as far as environmental regulations. And so his comments that regulations are driving dairy farmers off the farm is really not the truth.
Now, his other point was that there's economies of scale. Bigger farms can operate cheaper per unit. In effect, is there just some sort of economic change going here that we can't do much about? It's just bad news for smaller dairy farms.
Well, you know, if we were all on a level playing field, it might be a different story. You know, right now the taxpayers are subsidizing the largest of dairy farms in the state of Wisconsin and around the United States, too. We're looking at, you know, the state of South Dakota has got some pretty good programs going right now, inviting large farms into that state, and they get tax breaks and other advantages that the 50 to 200 cow dairy operators can't take advantage of.
What are you hearing from smaller scale dairy farmers around the state right now about what they're up against?
Well, you know, the majority of them really want to see some kind of a supply management program, something that could be put in place to make it more equitable, where all producers are going to receive the same benefits from the consumer dollar. Also hearing a lot of frustration over the current trade situation that's going on. These payments that are coming to farmers really are not covering much, if anything, as far as debt goes. Really, the payments that we've received the last 2 years don't even cover half of what our advertising bill is. That's a mandatory thing that we have to pay into the federal government to do generic advertising on dairy products. So, you know, we're hearing more and more that we should have more control over, number one, our production system and how much we produce to make sure that we bring supply and demand into balance.
Talking to Darren Von Ruden, dairy farmer in Westby, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, looking at small-scale dairy farms after comments from the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture yesterday here in Wisconsin at the World Dairy Expo. Darren, for people who aren't in the dairy business or in farming, they might say, well, you know, large producer, small producer, I'm getting my dairy products either way. What would you say to them about the importance of keeping viable, smaller scale operations in business?
Well, certainly looking at what happens with the rural economy and maybe more even the local economy when large farms from out-of-state owners come in, the question is how many of those dollars that firm generates actually stay in that local community. When they do their banking with a large bank, either in Chicago or New York, or maybe not even in this country, and they have you know, their equipment they buy from straight from the plant where it's being produced. Fertilizer, they're probably buying that from a port somewhere either on the Mississippi or one of the coasts, and so that money doesn't come back into that local community where that farmer's at. And then just looking at the labor force, too, you know, a lot of them do have immigrant laborers that are working there, and they certainly spend a little bit of money in the local community to take care of their daily needs. But what's left at the end of the month actually goes back to their home countries to support their families there. So, the big question is, how much that money is actually staying in these local communities.
Now, what are you seeing? We hear about a lot of farms closing. What have the numbers been like when it comes to farm closures, especially here in Wisconsin, Darren?
So back in April, we lost three farms a day in the month of April. We're over the two dairy farms per day average here for this year. Last year, we were right at that two dairy farms per day. So you look at the raw numbers. Back in the 80s, when we were losing three farms a day, we had 35 to 40,000 dairy farms in the state. At the end of 2018, we were down to around 7,500 dairy farms. So comparing the stress of the 80s to what we're seeing today, it's actually a lot worse on a percentage basis.
Is this a case, we hear a lot about how tariffs are affecting some kinds of agriculture in Wisconsin and around the country. Is that part of the story for dairy?
Well, yes, it is, and it has that ripple effect. It might not be impacting every farmer in the state directly, but it has that ripple effect because when you lose a market, product builds up, and then you have the backlog of product that has to be moved, and so that lowers everybody's price. And looking at losing markets that we've built up over the last 15 to 20 years, it's going to take 10 to 15 years to build those back up. So we're not going to see this immediate effect the day that the trade agreements might be signed. It's going to take some time to actually build those markets back up.
Now, you mentioned the idea earlier of dairy supply management. It might be a tough sell to a lot of stakeholders. Who do you see doing that? Would that be something the government would implement, or the dairy industry would work together on? How would that work?
It has to be something that involves the whole dairy industry, and then the government's going to be the oversight factor in there. If we look at how some of the other industries in this country have supply management programs, the farmers have a lot to say in what goes on, but it also has to involve the federal government to make sure that nobody's really a bad actor, but also protecting that industry from outside sources that will import products into this country at lower prices than what it takes for American farmers to produce that product.
We have a question from a listener, Darren, who wonders what, if anything, can consumers do to favor smaller producers here in the state?
Well, that's the hard question because we are a national industry, and what's going on is, it's frustrating because of the pricing system that we have. It's outdated and needs to be updated. So really, number one, they could talk to their elected officials and say that we need to find a mechanism that allows more producers to stay in business, diversify our production mechanisms versus going to the large scale, and that's the only type of production that we want to see. Diversity really is something that benefits both the producers and the consumers.
In our last few moments, Darren, I know prices have been low for commodity milk for quite a while now. I've heard there was a slight uptick. Are you seeing any improvement on the price front?
We're probably going to see a month here in October with the prices ticking up a little bit because of the way the markets were 2 months ago, but since then they've dropped again. And just looking at what's happening on the stock market, a lot of times commodity markets follow that same scale. So if we are seeing, drops in the stock market here over the last couple of weeks, we can probably see that in commodity markets too.
Darren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Darren Von Ruden, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. He was with us today to talk about the financial viability of smaller family farms, especially dairy farms, after U.S. Agricultural Secretary Sonny Perdue suggested yesterday that they might need to scale up to survive. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about first day jitters.
What do you feel when you think about the first day of school? Are you happy and excited with an optimistic look on the year? Or are you terrified and nervous with a ball of anxiety setting up shop in the pit of your stomach? For Joe Schaefer, they experienced all the emotions when they walked through the doors on their first day of school. Joe originally recorded the following essay about 6 years ago when they were a high school junior at Madison West. We're revisiting this story because it's been turned into an animation, and it'll air on the season premiere of Wisconsin Public Television's Wisconsin Life this week. Here's Joe.
The first day of school. Lockers will slam and bells will ring. Pencils will be sharpened and chairs will creak. You will see more people in one place than you have in months. If you're like me, you'll be nervous. I'll be a junior at West High in Madison this year. I've never been a very confident person, and the first day of school terrifies me. It's not just the return of homework and tests. The first day of school means relating to all your classmates. When you pass the 10 or so people who you actually know, you say hi. For the other 2,990, you stare straight ahead. You endure the feeling that for the past 3 months, everyone was having more fun than you. Meanwhile, you watched all 9 seasons of Everybody Loves Raymond. You shake it off and go to your first class. Now comes the worst part of all, the thing you've been dreading all summer, name games. The rules may vary, but the concept remains the same. Tell us about yourself. Let us get to know you. Expose yourself to judgment from your peers. The risk of humiliation is tremendous. Okay, class, the teacher says. Can you name 3 facts about yourself? Never has there been a more loaded question. They're not just asking for 3 facts. They're asking you to sum yourself up. Your heart is palpitating. You're sweating profusely. Why did you wear boots on the first day? It's still summer, but you just had to have that extra inch of height. You cleared 6 feet, but good God, at what cost? Now there's just one more kid away from your turn. The guy in the polo shirt is talking about how his uncle owns a farm. You're jealous. That's not really such a bad fact. Can you top it? Humor might be your best option, but then again, a joke is risky. What if no one laughs? Now the kid in the polo shirt has only one more fact to go. Turns out he's passionate about dirt bikes. Why aren't you passionate about anything? He works in a joke and it gets a chuckle. At this point, you would give your soul for a chuckle. Finally, it's your turn. There's a pause. Everyone's looking at you. The kid in the polo shirt seems so happy he survived. And then, a gift from the gods. The sweetest sound known to man. The clear, bright ring of the bell. Class is over. You pack up and meet your friends for lunch. You marvel at your good luck. Maybe this year won't be so bad after all.
That piece was written by Joe Schaefer, a former Madison resident who shared their first day of school jitters back when they were a high school junior. Joe now lives in New York City and works as a filmmaker and musician. Joe's essay was turned into an animation, which you can see on the season premiere of Wisconsin Public Television's Wisconsin Life this week. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, Wisconsin is home to many great conservationists who work to study our environment and preserve our natural areas. But not many of them also happen to be a dog. That honor goes to Tilia, a chocolate lab working at the Mequon Nature Preserve. She spends a lot of her time sniffing out animals and invasive species. Corey Gritzmacher is director of restoration and operations at the Mequon Nature Preserve. He works with Tilia. Corey, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, can you tell us how Tilia got started working with you on conservation there in Mequon?
Yeah, it really started as our executive director was searching the internet for a new family dog. And she really stumbled upon this idea of conservation dog and was really kind of got curious about it. Like, what do you mean? What's this all about? So, upon further investigation, I mean, it's kind of not an old idea. And it's not a new idea. I mean, it's been around for about 20 years, the idea of conservation dogs. And it's the similar idea that, you know, we see narcotic dogs or search and rescue dogs, or medical aid dogs, and all kinds of needs. And this is just one other way that dogs can help us out, with their amazing abilities is in the conservation world.
And one of the main chores, Corey, I understand for Tilia is hunting down wild parsnip even before you and I are probably going to see it. How does Tilia do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So she's trained to find the first year plants of wild parsnip. Wild parsnip is a two-stage or two-year plant, and the first year it's really low to the ground. It can easily be hidden by other prairie plants, other vegetation around it. And then the second year is when it shoots up a flower head, it bolts, and it sets seed. And that's when it becomes really spreads really rapidly that way. So we focused on our training to find that first-year plant that's really hard for us to find but easy for her to find in those prairie or those sensitive areas that we're searching.
When you're out on the hunt for wild parsnip with Tilia, I'd imagine that, okay, Tilia finds wild parsnip and barks or goes a little crazy. No, that's not how it works, right?
Correct. She, it's a very more of a passive response, I guess. She's going to pause wherever she's at, and she's going to wait for you know, if she's further ahead of me, she's going to wait for me there at that spot. And she's going to give me, that look and saying, hey, I found something. Something's here. And wait for me to investigate to confirm that's what she found. And then she gets rewarded. She gets a paycheck. Her reward is food. She's very food-driven. But other conservation dogs are very toy-driven or ball-driven as well. So they're looking for that reward. That's what kind of drives them. To keep working is that they know once they find something, they're going to get a toy or a treat of some sort. So they'll keep searching because they want that toy or that treat again. So
Tilia finds wild parsnip, which we want to get rid of. She also tracks down salamanders, which are not an invasive species. How does Tilia work with salamanders?
Yeah, so they're not invasive, but they're more elusive, right? So they're extremely difficult to find. We're looking for kind of absence and presence here on our property. We know we have a breeding population of salamanders here, but we have a very difficult time of finding them. So it's her job to do some monitoring efforts in the spring of the year and search our ephemeral ponds and looking for those salamanders underneath, you know, leaf litter, logs, rocks, or whatever it may be. And it's just so much more efficient because we don't have to go through the woods and slip over every rock and rake all the leaves looking for these tiny little creatures that are so elusive and difficult to find. So she's a lot more efficient. She's less invasive as well because it's just her and I walking through the woods and along the wetlands versus a team of people. So it's just a more efficient way of doing something.
Talking to Corey Gritzmacher from the Mequon Nature Preserve, talking about Tilia, the conservation dog who does a lot of work there. Corey, let's talk about the big projects going on at Mequon Nature Preserve. You have a really big restoration project that you and Tilia and others are working on.
Yeah, you can definitely say that. We're in the process of restoring about 400 acres of agricultural fields back to a mosaic of prairies, hardwood forests, and the wetland systems. So it's a pretty cool project. It's one of the largest protected green spaces in southeastern Wisconsin. And there's not too many people, you know, in the United States or in the state of Wisconsin that are doing tackling this size of a restoration project. So it's a very unique location. We're on the border of two major watersheds. So our property actually serves the Milwaukee River watershed and the Little Menominee River watershed as well. So it's pretty unique to southeastern Wisconsin to have a property that can affect two watersheds, and the work that we're doing here can really affect Everything else downstream, especially with, you know, we're talking about recent flooding events. Some of the restoration work by creating wetlands and reinstalling prairie and hardwood forests is going to affect and help prevent some of those massive flooding events that we've been seeing lately.
So Tilia is doing an important job here as part of all that. What does she do when she's off the clock?
She gets to be a family dog. She gets to be a dog. She gets to go home with our executive director, who's got two young kids, and she's got plenty of places to run and play and just have fun. So when she's at work, she's at work. But when she goes home at the end of the day, she can just be a family dog and just, you know, play fetch or, you know, chase rabbits or whatever she wants to do to have fun.
And Corey, before we let you go, can the public visit the Mequon Nature Preserve and maybe get to meet Tilia along the way?
Yes, most definitely. So the Mequon Nature Preserve is a nonprofit, but we're free and open to the public 365 days a year from sunup to sundown. There's over 5 miles of hiking trails. And our education center is open Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30. And Tilia is here most of those days. So if you stop in, feel free to ask if Tilia is around. I'd be more than happy to introduce her to you and tell her, tell you a little bit more about what she's doing here. So, yeah, we always encourage visitors. We love having visitors here.
Corey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you very much.
Corey Gritzmacher is the Director of Restoration and Operations at the Mequon Nature Preserve. He talked with us about his work with Tilia, the conservation dog. Tilia, by the way, is Latin for basswood. Probably heard about how important independent or moderate or undecided voters are to winning any election. The common wisdom is that to appeal to those voters, candidates should adopt more centrist viewpoints. But our next guest says that's not exactly true. He broke down the numbers for each group and found that their stances are a lot more complex than they're given credit for. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the political reform program at the think tank New America. He's the author of the upcoming book, Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. His recent piece for 538 is called The Moderate Middle is a Myth. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Rob.
Before we dig into the data you use to break this down, let's talk about this concept. There's this big group of people in the middle. They're to the right of the Democrats, to the left of the Republicans. Each party has to kind of triangulate to bring them over to their side. When you start digging, you find not so much?
Not so much. Certainly, there are a lot of voters who identify as moderates. Certainly, there are a lot of voters who identify as independents. But when you look at polling and see where they actually stand on issues, you find that they're kind of all over the place, and they're not at all concentrated in the political middle.
And a lot of times we see either party try to win over these alleged centrists, or we even see like Michael Bloomberg or the Starbucks guy, Howard Schultz, or other people say, I'm going to run a centrist campaign to appeal to this big group in the middle. This idea does seem to drive some people in politics, right?
It does, although, as you may have noticed with Howard Schultz's aborted candidacy, there was not much demand for that, as it turns out. Actually, it turns out what we've seen in American politics over the last few decades is that neither party has actually really tried to go after the political middle, especially the Republican Party, which has moved quite far to the right. So although there's this sort of conventional wisdom that parties need to move to the middle, we actually haven't seen political parties and political candidates doing all that much of it over the last few decades.
And you took each of these terms, the moderate, the independents, and the undecideds, and you tried to break down where they fall ideologically. Can you tell us what kind of data you looked like and what you used as a lens to see what they actually are thinking?
Yeah, so the data that I used comes from the Voter Study Group, which is a consortium of researchers who we've done some polling. It's supported by the Democracy Fund, which is a foundation, and put together an index of economic questions and immigration questions, given that those are two particularly salient issues in our politics, and just plotted everybody on a left-right spectrum, and created a two-dimensional scatter plot of the electorate. And what I found was that they kind of come from all over the electorate, although there are not very many voters who are pro-immigration and pro-leaving things up to the market. So there's not many libertarian voters in the electorate.
So let's break down each word now. We use sometimes independent, moderate, or undecided a little bit interchangeably, but you found different things when you plugged in each term. Let's start with the independents. Now, these are people who said, yeah, I'm an independent. They're self-declared in a way. How did they fall? What was the range of perspective on the economic and the immigration viewpoints?
Yeah, so they're all over the map. And, you know, all of these groups are kind of all over the map on these issues, right? So the conventional wisdom is that they're all kind of in the center. But in reality, some of them are quite liberal. Some of them are quite conservative on economics. Some of them are quite liberal on immigration. Some of them are quite conservative on immigration. Some of them are quite liberal on economics, but conservative on immigration. So there's really no single policy position that can win over independence. I mean, you know that campaigns are always talking about, well, we need to win over independence. Pundits are always talking about we need to win over independence. And then, you know, pundits will say, well, and if you adopt my preferred policies, then surely you will win over independence. But there's no single unified independent voter, right? They're all, so you could appeal to some independents, but then you'll lose other independents if you're in. So that makes it kind of maddening, but that's, you know, politics.
Talking to Lee Drutman from the think tank New America, he wrote a piece at 538 about myths about moderate, independent, and undecided voters. I want to throw a couple Facebook comments from the Ideas Network Facebook page into this. PJ writes, both parties are too extreme. For example, the left is very open about firearm confiscation, which makes me not want to vote for them. The right, PJ says, wants to limit a woman's right to choose, which makes me not want to vote for them. And Scott writes, I consider myself a libertarian, strongly left on some issues, strongly right on others. Say I have two choices. I pretty much split my vote evenly between Democrats and Republicans. So the independent isn't necessarily somebody in the middle from those two examples. And from what you looked at, it might be somebody who has opinions that don't match up with the set menu in either party.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of voters who don't quite match up with either party. And, you know, often they have quite strong positions and you know, on two or three or four different issues. And you know, then they will decide based on what issue they feel most strongly about. I think the two-party system actually does a quite poor job of serving most voters. We are a little bit more complex than just that simple binary. And in fact, that complexity is actually quite healthy for politics. I think one of the reasons that our politics has gone so haywire over the last few decades is that everybody who participates in politics has been forced into this zero-sum binary. And it's really simplified our thinking. The key to democratic stability in a broad sense is being able to engage with multidimensional complexity. And that's why I really do believe that in order to get past this current almost existential impasse in our democracy, we need to open up the party system by enacting electoral reforms that make it easier for third, fourth, fifth, even sixth parties to compete.
The moderate middle is a myth. That's the title of a recent piece from our current guest, Lee Drutman. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself a moderate or independent voter? Do you find yourself undecided, say, coming up the day before a presidential election day? What keeps you from identifying with one of the two major parties? What does moderate mean to you? What does independent mean to you? Do you find one party has something you like here, something you don't like over there? Call 800-642-1234. Do you want more parties in the mix? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Lee Drutman is with us, senior fellow in the political reform program at New America, looking at moderate, independent, and undecided voters. He says There's a lot more complexity than those words might hint at. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us if you consider yourself a moderate or independent voter and what that means to you. Lee, we talked about the independents. Let's talk about moderates. I mean, the word sounds like, okay, these are the people in the middle. They have moderation. They don't go too far to either side. What did you find when you plugged in the numbers there?
Well, the moderates are all over the place, although they do send, they do tend to cluster a bit more on the center left than other groups. Now, there's probably a good reason for that, which is that a lot of Democratic voters have decided not to call themselves liberals because the label liberal has been tarnished over the years and somewhat. Only somewhat recently have a lot of folks with views on the left decided that it's okay to call themselves a liberal. But the standard survey question is, are you a liberal, a moderate, or a conservative? So if you're not a liberal, you're not a conservative, then you're a moderate. And, you know, frankly, it's like a nice thing to call yourself. I mean, moderation is a virtue, right? So people like calling themselves moderate. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have moderate centrist policy views, but it may also mean that they think of themselves as having a moderate temperament, that they're just reasonable people, but that we shouldn't confuse that for political stances that are in the middle of the distribution.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sid is with us in Milwaukee. Sid, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's important that we, first of all, make sure that we don't get caught up into just two parties. I think the Democrats and the Republicans have caused a lot of problems. I'm an independent. I used to be a lobbyist, and I noticed how some elected officials, they would just jump party lines whenever it was convenient for them. So we really can't get caught up into the party. I'm really into the individual, what they're about, what their stances are on the issues that I'm concerned about. So we really need to get some more parties out there. You know, we just can't make it Democratic or Republican. We need to get some more options.
Sid, thanks for the call. I have a hunch we'll be calling you, Lee, to talk about your book when it comes out. But if you could spoil it a little, how do we get there from here, from mainly just two parties to one, five more? I don't know.
Well, the reason that we have two parties is not because Americans want only two parties. About two-thirds of Americans, in fact, agree with you, Sid, that we should have more than two parties. But we only have two parties because we have a winner-take-all single-member district electoral system. And given that, it's very hard for third parties to compete because they're treated as spoilers and they wind up the home of cranks and fringe views, and all the energy goes into one of the two major parties. Now, the first past the post single winner plurality system, it's really a quite antiquated system. It was a 1430 innovation. U.S. is one of only a few countries that still uses it. Most advanced democracies have moved to various forms of proportional representation, and there are a lot out there. The system that I think would work best in the U.S., given our political history, is a system that that the Irish have used for over 100 years. It's multi-member districts with ranked choice voting. So instead of having a single representative per district, you combine. I would say five would probably be the ideal, but it could vary. Five representatives into one district, and then the top five finishers represent that district in the legislature. And adding in ranked choice voting, I think, has a number of advantages, that it makes it easier for more candidates to compete and for voters to express the full range of their preferences. And it, you know, ranked choice voting, which has been used in Ireland and Australia for, you know, both countries for about 100 years, has a strong tendency to encourage coalition building, and it, you know, just engages voters in a way that they can express a full preference and vote for candidates who they may prefer, but who may not be likely to make it to win elections, and then they can, you know, have backup votes. So I think that would be the system that would work well. There are a variety of options out there, but the main takeaway is that the reason that we have only two parties is not because Americans want only two parties, is that we have an electoral system that makes it very hard for third, fourth, fifth parties to get a foothold.
Sid, thanks for that call. Lee, in our last minute and a half or so, I wanted to ask about the undecided voters. As a media guy, I picture somebody carefully weighing all their options, delving into all the information that's out there. What do we find when we actually look at undecided voters?
Undecided voters are all over the electoral map. Undecided voters also tend to be kind of the least politically engaged and the least predictable. Most people who pay close attention to politics tend to have a team and tend to be on that team. There are certainly a few undecided voters who are in the middle and who are carefully weighing the two options, but most undecided voters are going to choose somewhat randomly on atmospherics or last-minute news. So there's not really any clear policy position that's going to win over undecided voters.
So the message to politicians is, if you think you're reaching out to this massive untapped centrist vote, what should they do?
They should reevaluate their strategy, I think.
We'll leave it there. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Rob.
That's Lee Drutman, senior fellow in the political reform program at the think tank New America. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. He helped us break down the complexity of moderate, independent, and undecided voters. And there's still time for you to weigh in. If you consider yourself an independent voter, what does that mean to you? How do you shape your voting decisions as an independent? If you consider yourself a moderate, how about you? What does moderate mean in practice? If you find yourself undecided come Election Day eves, what is it that makes the final decision for you? You can join the conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or let us know on Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Some of the country's most profound health care challenges are playing out in rural areas that are struggling with populations that are relatively older and relatively sicker. In part three of a five-part series, reporter Mark Zdedlik of Minnesota Public Radio has the story of one rural hospital that's become accustomed to functioning in the red.
Not since 2006 has the Big Fork Valley Hospital taken in more money than it's spent on care. Despite the nonstop financial losses, it continues on.
I'll open the door for you.
Big Fork Valley Hospital CEO Aaron Saudi took me inside a relatively new memory care wing called Aspen Circle.
I love you.
Frank Sinatra wafts from a CD player.
This is a secure unit.
It feels like a homey lodge, open and airy.
A resident wants to wander. Can do that endlessly without hitting the end of a hallway and getting kind of confused.
Located in a remote area of northern Minnesota, Big Fork, population 445, is the smallest town in the state with a hospital. Operating in the red has been a way of life here. Opposite the memory care unit, the emergency room sits idle, but it's staffed up and ready. Saudi says the ER is not a moneymaker, but is a critical Big Fork Valley Hospital service.
So important for our community and then also for tourists, you know, when they get a fish hook in their hand or have chest pains.
The closest hospital is more than 40 miles away. Getting there, especially in the depths of winter, can be a harrowing trip. Dr. George Rounds says if the Big Fork Hospital ever shut down, some critically ill people might not survive the ride.
There is a thing called the golden hour. If you don't get to the hospital within that golden hour, your chances of survival are significantly less.
Newly published research from the University of Washington indicates there's a significant increase in the death rate for time-sensitive health problems in rural areas after a hospital serving the region has closed. Big Fork Valley Hospital is owned by a special unit of government called a hospital district. It has taxing authority throughout a 1,500-square-mile region because more than a dozen local governments agreed to join the district. Dr. Rounds retired after nearly 40 years at the hospital. He now chairs the district's board and has a front-row view of the ongoing financial struggles.
We'll keep limping along as long as we can.
Rural hospitals face unique challenges. They serve disproportionately older, sicker populations than their metro area counterparts. Patients are less likely to have insurance that covers the cost of care. The Minnesota Hospital Association says more than 1 in 4 Minnesota hospitals lose money on operations, most of them in rural parts of the state. Healthcare consultant Dan Zismer says financial pressures are forcing independent rural hospitals to join hospital systems with deeper pockets to stay open. That often leads to the elimination of local services, aside from some outpatient and emergency care.
Is healthcare going to go away from rural America? No, but it's probably going to continue to change pretty dramatically.
Like other remote hospitals, Big Fork Valley gets somewhat more generous payments from Medicare, but Round says they still lose money on Medicare patients.
Like if we bill $300 and they will allow $150.
The hospital doubled its levy effective this year, but it is not enough. Round says the area can't sustain a tax increase large enough to make up for all of the losses. Big Forks Hospital is able to keep its doors open amid the losses by spending money intended for maintenance and equipment. With more than 200 people on its payroll, Big Fork Valley Hospital is the biggest employer in town. It is also a prized asset here. 71-year-old Mike Koshin's family has owned the grocery store in Big Fork all his life.
We just love our hospital. We think so highly of our doctors. We're so proud of our facility.
Koshin says if the hospital shuts down, it would trigger a downward spiral for the local economy.
It's a tremendous asset to not only Big Fork, but all the surrounding communities.
Big Fork Valley Hospital CEO Aaron Saudi says the status quo is not sustainable.
We need to do something to turn it around because within 5 years, we could be in trouble.
Saudi says a hospital may have to surrender its independence and join a larger system. Given the demographic and economic trends challenging independent rural hospitals, affiliation may be the best option for many. Mark Zedeklik, NPR News, Big Fork, Minnesota.
Tomorrow, our series continues with a look at a University of Missouri program that immerses future doctors, nurses, and pharmacists in rural communities. These reports are part of a collaboration of 12 newsrooms that includes Wisconsin Public Radio. It's led by Iowa Watch and the Institute for Nonprofit News, with additional support from the Solutions Journalism Network. For more, you can visit hospitals.iowawatch.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a primary here, a caucus there, party members only here, anybody votes over there. We'll find out why the American presidential nomination process is such a mix-and-match patchwork of voting systems from one state to the next. There have been efforts to bring high-speed internet to rural areas in Wisconsin and elsewhere, but a guest tells us there are a lot of internet deserts in urban places, too. We'll look at impeachment, the history of, and why the lessons from past impeachments may not apply today. Historian David Greenberg joins the show for a look at what's similar and what is very different about the current impeachment inquiry and the efforts against Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon, and Andrew Johnson. And he's retired, but he's not done with music. Former UW-Madison marching band director Mike Lecrone joins the show for a look at the big band era. He's teaching a class on it, plus the most memorable songs, performers, and band leaders. You can share your favorites right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.